There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LeBurge. This is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. How do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversation? And how do we enter the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? Not just speaking our own minds or giving people a piece of our mind, but actually speaking the mind of Christ on the matters of the day and giving people the very peace of the mind of Christ. I think that's what we're called to do as his ambassadors. And I am thankful that you are entering into this conversation with me as we seek to bring God back into every conversation in ways that honor Jesus. So if you want some help with that, we've got resources online for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. You'll get lots of information and commentary that we don't have time to share here in this hour on the air. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LeBurge. All right, I want to start with a listener comment received earlier today. Listener says this: I hope you find time to talk about the Astros 13-12 win over the Dodgers in 10 innings that kept me up until 1:30 on your show today. All right, so here you go, Matt in Richmond. Here's my answer. The Astros represent a bright light shining across eternity. The Dodgers, well, they're dodgy. Dodginess is not generally associated with godliness. Plus, Houston is a city in recovery, and therefore the Astros are Houston strong. What does all of that mean? Absolutely nothing. It's a game. It's a series of games, in fact, and they play the games and all the outs of all the innings because anything can happen on any given night, which I suspect is why you stayed up watching until 1:30 in the morning. Now, if you lived on the West Coast instead of on the East Coast, the length of the game would not have bothered you so much because it would have, frankly, been over early. The outcome would have been the same. All right, I think I'm going to leave it right there. I don't really know how I'm going to bring God precisely back into the conversation about where we are at in the World Series of 2017. We had a lot to say about the World Series of 2016. If you want to go back and listen to the broadcast from a year ago, you can do that at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'm pretty sure we had a lot to say about the Cubbies' victory in 2016. All right, I am going to move to the headline news of the day. Paul Manafort has been indicted as a part of what we're calling the Mueller probe or the Russia probe or the probe into whether or not or how Russia sought to influence the U.S. presidential election in the year 2016. All right, many people are trying to make this about the president and make this a case of guilt by association. And so let's talk about that for a moment, and let's talk about what is happening in this. This is actually going to be a subject of conversation, not just today, pretty much in every environment, but it's going to be a conversation that's ongoing in our culture. So let me draw a few observations here. First of all, I think it appears increasingly likely that the Manafort indictment and actually the Gates indictment, Rick Gates has also been indicted. I think we're going to see these don't have anything to do with the Trump campaign. I mean, we're talking about indictments for issues from the years 2008 until 2014, before Paul Manafort was involved in the Trump campaign in any capacity. And while it's true that Robert Mueller began investigating Paul Manafort based on Manafort's dealings with the Trump campaign and questions related to Russia, you will remember that a special prosecutor can pretty much go anywhere that the thread leads, anywhere that, you know, as you start unfolding the pieces of trash, anywhere that each one of those little folds and crevices leads, you can go. So you may think that it went off the trail of campaign issues, but it stayed hot on the trail of crimes against the United States. That's pretty much what the special prosecutor is interested in, discovering where are the crimes, if any, exist, and how should we pursue those? So we're talking about very serious crimes, 12 counts, again, spanning 2008 to 2014. Conspiracy to launder money, big money, many tens of millions of dollars of money. But maybe most seriously, in fact, I would certainly say most seriously, conspiracy against the United States. So that's like treason. I mean, it might not be called treason, but that's like, right? If you're going to conspire against your own country, that's bad. And so we're talking about serious crimes, but there's nothing related to Trump nor even the 2016 presidential campaign in these 12 counts in this indictment. Paul Manafort and Rick Gates have pled not guilty to the charges. Both presented themselves this morning in the D.C. Circuit where the FBI demanded they appear and pled not guilty to the charges. You're going to hear a lot of talk in the media about, hey, where there's smoke, there's fire. And you're going to hear people observe that even if there's no fire in relationship to President Trump, the smoke itself might suffocate people, might be very dangerous to live in a house where something's on fire somewhere, creating a lot of smoke. That's the guilt by association conversation. And I think that for Christians, one of the things that we often need to remind ourselves of is that guilt by association is actually a real thing. And so who are you spending time with today? Are you influencing them or are they influencing you? What kind of leaven are you? There are leavening influences in our lives. Jesus warned us about them, and he also encouraged us to be a leavening influence. So he warned us against the leaven of the Pharisees. That's the idea that not everything that you are being instructed or taught, even by people in positions of authority and leadership, are right or righteous things. And so you have to beware the leaven of the Pharisees. But on the other hand, we're supposed to be the leaven in the loaf. We're supposed to be the leaven in the lump. We're the ones that are supposed to be the leavening influence in society, the salt, the light, the leaven. And so what does that mean? Well, that means we're supposed to actually be influencers of rightness and righteousness in the culture. And so what kind of counselor are you in the conversations that you're having with others? If other people were going to be determined to be guilty by association with you, what kind of guilt would that be? And if you were brought up on charges, this is always a great conversation to have in this context. What kind of charges would be brought against you in any kind of cultural conversation about whether or not you're a Christian? What kind of evidence would be presented in support of the claim that you're a Christian? What kind of evidence would be brought forth, and what kind of witnesses would be brought forth against you? If you were trying to say, no, I really am a Christian, well, where's the evidence of that? Where's the fruit? If we went through your trash, what would we find? If we woke you up in the middle of the night and we seized everything that's in your house and your computer hard drive and your phone records and everything else, what would we find? Would we find evidence of a Christian life? Would we find evidence of something else? Yes, we're going to absolutely subpoena all your bank records and we're going to look at all your financial dealings. And are we going to see evidence there of a Christian life? Are we going to see evidence of something else? And so in your conversations with others about what these people are enduring, first of all, I think we need to be humble in our conversations when others are criminally indicted for anything, right? So people are innocent until proven guilty in our culture. In our system. And so let's be mindful of that. Let's also be mindful that there's lots of energy and hyperbole in the conversations related to this. Let's also remember that what we're talking about is something that has a lot of political heat related to it. Now, I don't think it helps that the president has referred to this again as a witch hunt. However, on the day before Halloween, witch hunt is actually an opportunity for you to enter into the conversation and say, you know what, they're actually, that's an interesting thing for the president to say about that subject matter. I don't know if that subject matter is, if the Russia probe is actually a witch hunt or not. But I will say that if you want to talk about witches and you want to talk about paganism and you want to talk about the occult in our culture today, it is on the rise. So you might, as a Christian, in a conversation where you want to reframe the conversation or turn it from, you know, frankly, political exhaustion, which is where this conversation is going to quickly lead, and it's going to lead into very divisive conversations about which side of the argument you're on in terms of Hillary and uranium and all kinds of other things, or whether or not you're going to stick with the subject matter of the witch hunt and say, okay, let's talk about that. That's actually something that is seriously spiritual. And so on the day before Halloween, or even on Halloween, you could have a conversation with somebody else about real spiritual influences. You could have a conversation with them about the occult. You could have a conversation with them about the rising attention that Americans are giving to pagan practices. You could talk about the fact that Halloween has catapulted itself up the ladder pretty quickly of consumer holidays in America. You know, where your money is, there your heart is also. I didn't make that up. The Bible actually says that. And so if we want to look at where people are spending their money in terms of holidays in America, number one, still Christmas. Yay. Guess what number two is? Number two is Halloween. Like, it catapulted past Valentine's Day. So the holiday of love has been surpassed by the holiday of death and the celebration of pagan rituals and practices and beings and the living dead, the walking dead, the vampires, the zombies, on and on and on and on. So that might be a conversation that you want to have when somebody says, hey, it's a witch hunt. You can say, hey, let's actually stop and talk about that concept and that reality. I will acknowledge that President Trump is going to be tempted, in fact, already proven to have been tempted, to meet sort of this action, these indictments, with action. You know, he likes to punch back, but I think that his counterpunch tendency makes him seem like he's either trying to influence what is supposed to be an independent investigation, or that he does not, in fact, perceive himself to be the man holding the most powerful office in the whole world. And so, Mr. President, if you wanted to set that phone down for a couple of days and let this pass, that might be, wise counsel. Consider your counselors, sir. Consider carefully whose counsel you're listening to, and maybe set your phone down for a couple of days and let your thumbs have a rest. Okay. Some of this conversation over the weekend has been about opposition research, because there's actually this dossier. So this is now I am participating in the hey, all of this Mueller investigation stuff is connected, and all of it's important, and we should be paying attention to it in regards to who paid for what in terms of opposition research. So let me talk for a moment about opposition research. There is this dossier that was produced, and you and I probably became aware of it when it was presented to then candidate Donald Trump. But by that point, a lot of other people had already seen it. The president of the United States, then Barack Obama, had seen it in a briefing, which means it was regarded by his national security advisors as a very, very important thing. Well, it was, if you then like track back who was paying for it, the FBI was sort of the last group to pay for it. But prior to that, it was the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. But prior to that, it was donor who was actually trying to keep Donald Trump from becoming the candidate. So this goes all the way back to the primaries. So what is opposition research, and what's wrong with doing it? There's probably nothing wrong with doing it. The issue would be when you're actually involving a foreign government or foreign entities in the U.S. presidential election process by getting them to produce negative information. Which is, opposition research is only interested in negative information. Your opponent is frankly not interested in building you up in positive ways. Okay, this is not an encouraging, this is not like, oh, look at all the wonderful things that we discovered about this person. No, this is dirt digging. This is muckraking. So here's the conversation that I think you can have when the conversation that you're in turns to this dossier and who funded it and what's in it and da-da-da. I want you to consider this. Each and every one of us has opposition. We have an opponent. There is one who has set himself up against us eternally. There is an enemy. And he is even now prowling around, constantly looking for an opportunity to devour us. That means he's mucking. He's muckraking. He's trying to stir up all of the evil and detestable things. His goal is to tempt, confuse, kill, and destroy us. That's it. So, I just want you to ask yourself for a moment, if the devil were busying himself doing a little opposition research on you, what would that opposition research look like? What would the Carmen dossier contain? The truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth? No, quite the contrary. You have to remember that the dossier is a political document, intentionally constructed to bring a person down, destroy their reputation, impugn their character, and ensure their defeat. So, in the grand scheme of things, in the reality of the gospel universe, we have serious opposition, the devil. But we also have an advocate, a champion, a savior, who pleads our case and covers our sins and speaks the truth over us. So I want you to remember that when these conversations are flying around in the culture about opposition research and trying to dig up dirt on each other and saying nasty things. First of all, that's just not the way of God's people. Like, if you want to busy yourself finding out about other people, try to find out all the good. Try to find out all of the things that would be worthy of encouraging them and building them up. There's plenty of folks trying to tear other people down. Don't be those people. Be the building up people. Okay, so I have no good segue, none whatsoever. I wish I had some music to play so I could just make a segue to my next story and issue, because I have no good segue here. I want to talk about what's going on in Hollywood or surrounding the Hollywood crowd. I want to talk about I don't want to continue addressing the Harvey Weinstein issue, although it seems as if the number of women accusing Harvey Weinstein of sexual violence continues to grow. This group of women, it seems as if this is a never-ending, horrible confessional expose. And you're seeing other people who women are now coming forward to accuse of sexual harassment and worse. The next wave of exposure in Hollywood is now also rising, and that wave is pedophilia, and it includes homosexual advances on very young actors. And so if you thought that the Harvey Weinstein stories were gut-wrenching, it's about to get worse. And I think that people need to be aware and prayerful and not take, please do not take the I told you so approach to this conversation. Please be the Christian who enters into this conversation with a broken heart for the people who went to Hollywood with big dreams and aspirations and were robbed of their childhood and robbed of their human dignity and robbed of the future filled with hope that God had planned for them in terms of their identity as image bearers. And in terms of their sexual identity and introducing confusion and pain into their lives. So let's be Christians who advocate here for the dignity of every person and the goodness of sex as God's gift when enjoyed in the right context. So I'll share with you a couple of headlines that are particularly disturbing from this Hollywood conversation. Amidst the current rash of disgusting allegations of sexual harassment and assault surrounding the TV and film industries, particularly in reference to Harvey Weinstein, we now have former child actor Corey Feldman. Now, Corey Feldman has for a long time been a lone voice accusing Hollywood of systemic pedophilia. And he sat with Matt Lauer on the Today Show to discuss past and now forthcoming allegations. He is now what some would describe as a self-proclaimed missionary that wants to clean up Hollywood and expose the truth behind what he describes as systemic Hollywood pedophilia. He talks about it being a part of the culture of Hollywood. And he's trying to raise $10 million for the production of a related documentary. Now, $10 million is an enormous budget for just about any kind of documentary. But Corey Feldman has been a loud and consistent voice calling out what he saw and experienced in terms of child pedophilia and what he describes as a child pedophilia ring in the Hollywood-based showbiz industry. And so if you thought that the female sexual assault stories were disturbing, prepare yourself for more disturbing revelations out of the culture of Hollywood. And here's what I just think that we need to recognize. When you embrace an entirely hedonistic worldview, it should be no surprise that the satisfaction of the self in whatever way that has to be pursued is viewed as okay. Enter Kevin Spacey. So an actor whose name is Anthony Rapp has accused Kevin Spacey, whose name you very well may recognize, of making sexual advances at him when Anthony Rapp was only 14 years old. So this is from 1986. Kevin Spacey was then 26 years old. Again, Anthony Rapp was 14 years old. The allegations are quite specific. They are not G-rated, so we won't read them here. But in response to the allegations, Kevin Spacey tweeted that, quote, he was beyond horrified to hear Rapp's story. Okay, so just note that for a second. As if it's not his story. As if it's a story told by another person about a situation that he experienced. Mr. Spacey, it's a story about you. It's an experience in which you are the perpetrator. It's an experience in which you robbed a person of their dignity. Spacey went on to tweet, I honestly do not remember the encounter. It would have been over 30 years ago. Well, it's obviously something that is still in the forefront of the moment-by-moment memory of another person. So this is important to recognize, that the perpetrator, that the person who is victimizing the victim, the perpetrator often does not remember the individual or the incident. The victim can never forget it. And so I think that when we start, as Christians, entering into these conversations, we must recognize that below the surface of many people's pretty facades, happy facades, are these horrendous memories, some of which date back a really long time. And so as Christians, I think we've got to be prepared to be the people who respond, recognizing that there's a lot of pain that people have experienced, and there's a lot of pain that has been perpetrated by, I'll use the word leaders, because they're at least well-respected in their industries, and that public statements of coming out. So that's what Kevin Spacey used this as an opportunity to do, by the way. He used this as an opportunity to come out and share that he is now choosing to live as a gay man, having enjoyed relationships with both men and women, according to his own statement. And you are going to hear a symphony of critics related to this. You're going to hear critics who say this is a totally inappropriate time and way and platform in which to come out. And inappropriate to put these two things together as if homosexuality and pedophilia are related. Well, folks, a lot of folks have been pointing out that homosexuality and pedophilia are related for a really long time. So just recognize that these are the emerging conversations. You may not be reading about them yet, but you are going to be reading about them. Kevin Spacey is accused of trying to molest and rape a 14-year-old boy. Please do not allow the media to confuse the issue and turn it into some kind of celebration of Spacey coming out as a gay man. And so that's what I want you to be watching for. I want you to be clear about what the issues are, and I want you to be clear that God's good gift of sexuality is intended to be enjoyed in a particular context. And that particular context is between the covenantal marriage of a man and a woman. All right, friends, when we come back, we are going to be talking about the Reformation, but we're not going to be talking about Martin Luther. We're going to be talking about his sassy wife. All right, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is The Reconnect. We're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. All right, friends, it is the week during which we are every day highlighting something about the Protestant Reformation. We've been talking about this for months now. We're going to be talking about it in the year ahead. We are Protestant Christians, and so we wouldn't be Protestant Christians had there not been a Protestant Reformation, which started in protest. And so parts of that conversation center around Martin Luther. We talk about him a lot. Well, Martin Luther is a fascinating character, but he's not a man who lived as a monk in terms of his ecclesiastical status forever, nor in terms of his personal life. He was a guy who got married, and the woman that he married is a fascinating, fascinating character in her own right. So we're going to talk about Katie Luther, First Lady of the Reformation. That's actually the name of the book, Katie Luther, First Lady of the Reformation, the unconventional life of the wife of Martin Luther. And here to talk with us about that is Dr. Ruth Tucker. She is the author of the book. She has taught mission studies and church history at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and Calvin Theological Seminary. She's been published in a myriad of places. She's the author of 18 books. And she's here to talk with us today about her latest book about Martin Luther's wife, Katie Luther. Ruth, welcome to The Reconnect.
Oh, it's delightful to be with you, and I love talking about Katie Luther.
Yeah, so for those who don't know her, sum up her life for us, and then we're going to go back and talk about sort of how she got to this place. But sum up her life for us, if you can.
Well, she was at age five, not orphaned, but she lost her mother, and she was among several children. And her father quickly remarried a widowed woman with several children, and Katie was taken at age five, imagine a little kindergarten, to a convent where she stayed until she was 10. And that was a Benedictine convent where she got a real good education. At 10, she was moved to another convent to study to take her vows as a cloistered nun. And so she was in a convent for nearly 20 years of her life before she escaped.
All right, let's talk about her escape. The whole idea that she would escape from a convent, like there could be that in and of itself is fascinating. So what are the circumstances surrounding that?
Well, it's really the greatest conspiracy, religious conspiracy of the 16th century and one for the record books. You have cloistered nuns who have taken a vow of silence, and not just that, but have vowed to marry Jesus. So to leave the convent and to leave your life as a nun, it is comparable to divorcing Jesus. That's not a decision made lightly. 12 nuns who had taken a vow of silence somehow connected with each other in that convent and agreed together to divorce Jesus, and not one of them got cold feet. From the outside, they were connecting with Luther and others, and it was a capital crime for Luther or somebody else to kidnap nuns. And it was considered kidnapping whether they wanted to get out or not. So late one night, it was actually Easter Eve, of 1523, that a herring wagon with barrels of herring came into the convent, and he'd apparently done this before late at night, and he left with 12 nuns rather than herring barrels. And that in itself is an incredible conspiracy. They got out, all the nuns either went back to their families or they got married. Katie was the last nun to, she couldn't go back to her family, and no one wanted to marry her. She was considered proud and domineering, and nobody wanted her for a wife. In the meantime, she fell in love with Jerome Baumgartner, and he loved her. He liked her spark and her liveliness, but he goes home to tell his folks about it, and they were outraged that he would consider marrying an impoverished runaway nun, and he was a real cad. He did not even get back to Katie to break up their engagement. He was a university student, and he was a student of Martin Luther's. So that was a heartbreak of her life. She was not in love with Luther. But there was nobody else, and she proposed to Luther and one other reformer. The other reformer did not want her because she was too proud and domineering. Luther finally agreed to take her as his wife. He was no catch. He was in his 40s at the time. She was in her 20s, so he was an old man at that time. He also was very crude and foul language they used often, and he simply was not hygiene was a horrible problem for him. He slept in a bed of sweat and must and everything else for a year without changing at a straw bed. So he was no catch of the 16th century at all. Jerome Baumgartner would have been. She wanted a husband. She was not looking for a reformer.
Okay, so I already just love the character who you're describing, right? I mean, she's a real human being. I think sometimes when we imagine history, we imagine these people, I mean, Martin Luther included, as something that's something other than just a regular human being with gross sweat. And yet you are describing these people in the reality of who they are, the struggles of life, the pain of being left at an orphanage as a child, the added, I mean, you know, we think about people becoming nuns by choice. We think that people choose to go and commit themselves to that life. That's not her experience. And so this idea that she would have to escape and pursue a marriage that maybe wasn't her dream person, like, that's reality.
It is a reality. And, you know, she, I think, was made far stronger by being sent off to a convent. Her mother is dead, and you can imagine the pain of a little five-year-old. But that gave her incredible strength, and the men around her all thought she was proud and domineering. She was just a very strong woman. After she married Luther, she bought farms. She put the Black Cloister into business. So it was like a boarding house / Holiday Inn. A lot of people came. She made money on it, and it was through her work there that Luther was able to sit around the table and talk at night. Students and colleagues took notes, and that became table talk. And so much of what we know about Luther is from table talk. And she also kept him above board physically, mentally, and fiscally. He let money slip through his fingers. He would have let everyone come and stay at the Black Cloister without paying. She said, no way. This cost her money, and she was going to buy farms and gardens and make this a going enterprise. And mentally, he was not stable at all, especially during the mid-20s and beyond when she married him. And physically, he was just a wreck. You know, he's an old man. And 16th century, when you're 40-some years old, that's not so uncommon. And it was those 20 years of their marriage that Luther formed the Protestant Reformation. Nobody else will admit that. Nobody else says that. Because, yes, he had come against indulgences, and he talked about salvation by faith alone. Others had talked about that. What Luther did differently during those 20 years, he pointed the Reformation to the focus on the family. His theology of the family and his emphasis on it, his significant criticism of celibacy and monasticism, that's not the way God intended. God intended marriage and family, and he displayed that. Other reformers did not want him to get married because they said a monk marrying a nun would be a terrible scandal. And it was. It was a scandalous 16th century. But he displayed his family, 6 children. His wife was a midwife for others. She was known in the community as a no-nonsense person. It was an egalitarian marriage. She ran the show at home in many ways. Not his business, and she adored him. She came to adore him, he to adore her, his Lord Katie. And they had a wonderful 20-year marriage, although they had much sadness, too, as 2 of their children died.
All right, friends, I know that as you're listening to this, you're thinking to yourself, I want more of that. Well, the book is entitled Katie Luther, First Lady of the Reformation. The author is Ruth Tucker, and Ruth is sharing with us now her insights into the character of the wife of Martin Luther. And I'm with you, Ruth. I think this woman shaped Reformed theology because she shaped the experience that Martin Luther had in terms of the reality of a family. And so let's talk about her as a businesswoman, and then let's also talk about her spiritual life.
Well, she was a very clever businesswoman, and she hired a lot of workers. She couldn't have done it herself. She owned farms. She bought farms, and she had big gardens. She had a lot of animals and producing things. She was the brewmeister of Wittenberg. It was not safe to drink water, and she brewed the beer, and, of course, Luther liked his beer. So in many ways, she just was the woman behind him, not out front at all. In fact, the people around town did not care for Katie Luther at all. And the other reformers were not, they did not like her. For one thing, she was not like other wives of the reformers, and she was not a reformer in her own right. There were many women at the time in the 16th century who spoke out strongly for the Reformation. Katie Luther did not. In fact, there is no evidence that she actually converted to the Reformation. She married Luther, she adored him, and she supported him in every aspect of his life. But she, as a nun, was a religious, and that's a noun. She's a religious, a nun. And she leaves the convent behind, and she becomes a secular. Luther chided her often for not praying enough, for not reading the Bible. At the time of her death, it was said her final words were, I will cling to Christ like a burr to a wool skirt. Now, she certainly would have known how burrs cling to wool skirts, but that was not her line. That was said only two centuries later, and it was later brought back and saying as a final word for Katie, but she didn't say that. There's no evidence that she was deeply spiritual at all. She was devotional and spiritual when she was in the convent, but she had left that behind. She was a secular woman, a mother and a farmer and a Holiday Inn matron.
Now, my guess is that gets you into some trouble when you start suggesting that Martin Luther's wife was not, she might have been a Proverbs 31 woman in some ways, but in other ways, we don't see her as a person who has her own robust devotional spiritual life.
Well, neither the Proverbs 31 woman. You look at that, and there's no robust spiritual life there as well. And yes, I may get in trouble, but there is no evidence that she was spiritually inclined. Luther gave forwards to tracts of other nuns who had escaped and other women who were supporting the Reformation. He just so strongly endorsed them. There's never once where Luther is endorsing Katie as somebody who's been born again. He talks about being born again. He talks about prayer life. He talks about devotional life. He talks about God. His letters are filled with that. He offers to pay Katie to read the Bible. He says if you pray more, your midwifery work in the neighborhood would go better. And she says, we are too busy keeping the mother and baby alive. You men are the ones that are supposed to be praying. She said she prayed furiously at the convent, but no longer.
That is so interesting. I just think that's one of the most interesting storylines or threads in her life's drama.
And we have a Protestant Reformation, truly as we know it, without Katie Luther.
Okay, so, and why do you say that? Let's highlight that point one more time. What makes her so indispensable?
Well, first of all, she really truly kept Luther alive, mentally, physically, fiscally, for 20 years of their marriage. And that is significant because Luther could have easily gone off the rails any three of those ways. But then she also pointed toward the family. His doctrine was very significant, but others had been saying similar things. Previous reformers and other reformers of his day were not so focused on the family, and that, more than any single doctrine, I would argue, sets Protestantism apart from Catholicism, of the age, the 16th century, and to some extent in the centuries since. Because for Protestants, the most religious people are those who devote their life to Christ as celibate. And they are often in convents or monasteries or they're priests. But Protestants hold high the family. And Luther started that out with his wife, Katie.
Oh, I just think it's so fantastic. Ruth Tucker, thank you so much for sharing Katie Luther, First Lady of the Reformation, with us and with the world. Friends, you can check out the book at zondervan.com. Again, it's Katie Luther, First Lady of the Reformation. Ruth Tucker, thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
My pleasure, and it's also ruthtucker.com, but thank you so much.
Oh, fantastic, ruthtucker.com. All right, friends, it's time to go Below the Fold, the point in the show where we lift up stories and make connections that, well, they probably didn't make it into the headlines of the day, but we think that they're significant, they're important, they are they're culturally relevant, and you need to know about them. And it's an opportunity for you to engage with others in conversations that might turn the tide, might turn the way someone is thinking about something. And you and I all know that ideas have consequences. So if you can influence what somebody is thinking about, you can ultimately influence the way they live. So today's Below the Fold comes from, well, I pulled it off of CNN, but there's actually a lot of news outlets covering this story. And it's about a church. It's about a particular church in Alexandria, Virginia. It is a 244-year-old Episcopal church, and it happens to be the church where George Washington worshipped. So we're talking about the way people would refer to this is George Washington's church. Now, just by virtue of the fact that we refer to it as George Washington's church, I think that right there as Christians, we have to take a pause and recognize George Washington doesn't have a church. Jesus has a church. So by virtue of the fact that this one particular church is already significantly identified with George Washington, we have to pause as Christians and recognize that whatever church you go to, that's not your church. The church that I go to, that's not my church. My pastor's name is Scott. It's not Scott's church. Right? Your pastor's name is Roy. It's not his church. It's not Bob's church. It's not Joe's church. Okay, it's Jesus' church. It's his bride. He died to create her, and he is awaiting her. She's going to be presented to him holy and blameless. Now, whether or not local people who are part of a local congregation or a particular church are actually found to be members of the church eternal, the church triumphant, the bride of Christ, that is up to God. I mean, God knows who's actually in the church and who isn't. You and I can hold membership in a particular congregation, and we are baptized, and we believe in our hearts, confess with our mouths, and believe in our hearts that Jesus is the Christ and God raised him from the dead, and so the scripture says we will be saved. The reality is, it is about Jesus' church and you and I being found to be a part of it. So, whether or not there is a plaque or a placard or anything else on the wall of a physical church building somewhere in the world that bears your name and is given in honor or memory of you is completely irrelevant to your salvation. So let's just keep that in mind for a moment. Neither the saved reality of George Washington nor Robert E. Lee, who is probably more the character at issue here, whether or not either of these two men now is a part of the church triumphant, not at issue. What's at issue are marble plaques affixed to a building in a town called Alexandria, in a state called Virginia, in a nation called the United States of America in the year 2017. So let's just be clear about what we're talking about. Let's get a little perspective on what we're talking about before we pull out our hair and set the world on fire. that some plaques are being removed from the wall of a church. Because that's basically what's happening. Some plaques, like, it's not quite as simple as getting the plaque removed from your teeth, but let's just think for a moment about what we're talking about. We're talking about removing plaques from one location in a church and moving them to another location. We're not even talking about removing them from the church property. We're talking about removing them from where they are right now and putting them somewhere else. Okay, now that you are hopefully have a little perspective on it, let me tell you what's going on. In response to the violent protests over the fate of a Confederate statue in Charlottesville earlier this year, this 244-year-old Episcopal church in Alexandria has entered into conversations that have resulted in their vestry deciding that they need to move these plaques. The plaques were hung on either side of the altar in the church in 1870. So let's just be clear, okay? 1870 is when the plaques went up. All right, I don't really have a date in front of me about when George Washington was around, but I think that that's way past his time. Okay, so these are definitely memorial plaques. Okay, so this is not, this is not where he put his hand on the wall and prayed or something like that. Okay, so these plaques have actually been under discussion, and the relocation of these plaques have been under discussion. Remember, they flank the altar. They've been under discussion for a really long time. Why? Because nobody sees any religious purpose for having such plaques on the wall in memory of people who aren't Jesus. Okay, that would be part of what's going on here. But here's the quote that has everybody all riled up today. After the events in Charlottesville, these conversations came more to the forefront and became more intense, said Noel York Simmons, the rector of Christ Church. I hadn't yet told you that that was the name of the church, because I'd like to get to that in just a minute. This is, by the way, Christ Church. It's not Washington's church. It's not Lee's church. It's Christ Church. And so there's going to be a lot of hullabaloo about whether or not, remembrances and acknowledgments and honorariums to Washington and Lee are moved to some demoted location on the church grounds, when really what we should be talking about is whether or not the name of Christ is exalted in this church at all. What we should be concerning ourselves with is whether or not this church is embarrassed over Jesus. Are they actually declaring the good news of the gospel of Christ to the world? Or do they just have a little bit of a memorial to him as well? Like, these are serious conversations. When you start talking about whether or not we are going to offend people with the gospel, whether or not we're going to offend people with the name of Jesus, we're going to move very quickly in this conversation from taking Washington and Lee out of places of prominence and shoving them over to the side, and we're going to get into a really quick conversation about Jesus Christ and whether or not Christ Church, in this case, Christ Church Episcopal Alexandria, Virginia, is ashamed of the name of Jesus, is ashamed of Jesus. This was a small colonial parish founded in 1773. It is still small. It is no longer particularly colonial. The plaques were installed as a pair, so they are being removed as a pair, so says the article on CNN's website. Here is a further quote from Emily Bryan, the senior warden of Christ Church. Again, that is the vestry. She says, we want to move them to a place that will better tell our history. Well, my question to Christ Church is this. Worse than being ashamed of Washington, are you ashamed of Jesus? Okay, the most famous person associated with a particular church needs to be Jesus. Maybe that is really the problem. All right, friends, that's literally all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Please connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. Donate to the ministry. Share today's show with someone new. Have a great day. God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.